Well, hello there. This is the Vital Gut Health Podcast, and I'm your host, Jake Thurston. Now, I have a very special guest today, and I cannot wait to introduce you to him. His name is Dr. Rodney Dietert. He's an award-winning researcher on the microbiome. Professor Dietert presents a new paradigm in human biology that has emerged in the midst of the ongoing global epidemic of non-communicable diseases, what he calls NCDs. The Human Superorganism, his book, makes a sweeping paradigm-shifting argument. It demolishes two major fundamental principles that have been long held in scientific and medical literature. Ultimately, his book is not just about microbes. It's about a different way to view humans. The story that Dietert tells is of where the new biology comes from, how it works, and the ways in which it affects our lives. It's absolutely fascinating, authoritative, and I will tell you, it's revolutionary information. He identifies foods that best serve you, the superorganism. Not new fad foods, but ancient foods that have made sense for millennia. He explains protective measures against unsafe chemicals and drugs. He offers an empowering self-care guide and the blueprint for a revolution in public health. Dr. Rodney Dietert is a professor of immunotoxicology at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. He received his PhD in immunogenetics from the University of Texas at Austin. He appeared in the 2014 award-winning documentary Microbirth. In 2015, he received the James G. Wilson Publication Award for the best paper of the year on the microbiome. Now, with that lengthy introduction, but you've got to understand what we've got here. Dr. Rodney, I introduce you. How are you?
I'm just great, Jake, and I really appreciate the chance to be on your program and visit with you today.
Oh, that's great. I'm excited to talk to you. So your book is really one of the cutting-edge pieces of writing in this field right now, and I'm super excited to chat with you about some of the stuff in there that I think you are revealing that many even of the highest-end doctors on the subject don't even have in their book. So I read a lot about this stuff, and we try to research as much as we can, and man, this is a great book. I mean, The Human Superorganism, so good. I want to kind of dive in here today and kind of start with what's the story behind this book? You writing it and part of your professional career, if you could give us a background.
Right. Well, I think the best word to use is serendipity, and maybe that's a good thing for young scientists to remember if they're going to have a long career is you have lots of things that you don't anticipate that show up, and they can really direct you into some very exciting opportunities and information. So in this case, it's not that I've worked on the microbiome for I've been a professor at Cornell over 40 years now, and most of my work was actually on the immune system in early life, so the infant, the baby, the infant's immune system and how to protect it. And it was really through an opportunity to write a paper to identify the single thing you could measure in a newborn baby that would be the best predictor of that baby having a life filled with health or one filled with disease. And we all understand that, you know, what you eat and what you experience in life affects your health. So it's not that those things aren't important. They're very important. But what would be the thing you could measure, the single thing that would be a predictor? And, boy, I thought I had the answer after working for decades on the developing immune system. And so I tried to write, start this paper that was really a challenge to make an argument and identify that, and I got nowhere with it. I mean, it was very frustrating. It was I couldn't convince myself of the what I was starting with, and went to bed that night and woke up in the middle of the night from a very vivid dream. I don't really remember the details of the dream, but what I woke up with was the idea that, well, it's very simple. The baby has to self-complete, and that is the baby forms what came to be known as the completed self, and that is to have all of those microbial partners that we need that join us to function as a superorganism. And so that was really the start, was it was this 3:30 a.m. waking up with this, wow, what an amazing idea, and my wife kind of helped me piece together the jumble of that from the middle of the night. We wrote a paper together, It got seen by two UK filmmakers, even though it was published, ironically, in a physics-oriented journal called Entropy, and you don't really look for biology in physics journals very often. It nevertheless was seen. They featured me explaining that idea and concept as one of the elements of their 2014 award-winning movie, Microbirth. And I wrote more papers, and some of them won awards, and got to speak about this, and despite not having worked on the microbiome for decades, as many researchers have, essentially I was able to come at it from maybe a slightly different perspective. And at least I've been told that's useful. It's actually useful to take it, look at things, get a fresh look. And so that's what I hope I'm bringing to the topic of health and us being a superorganism and how we can lead a life that really supports us as something more awesome than we ever dreamed. So that's how it started. It literally was waking up in the middle of the night, an idea from a dream, changing my career in a very useful way.
Wow, that gives me chills. You're just saying that. I think about what you just mentioned is so on par with reading your book and reading it again. It really is amazing the perspective you've taken, because some of these folks are very steeped in traditional thought and don't even begin to look at some of the research that might question some of their methodologies and some of the things that they're maybe giving them new. You're giving it new questions to ask and coming at a different way that they may not, because they're clouded by all of the research they've done. So you had said that for the longest time you tried to write this paper on the fetal immune system and came up with this idea that they had to become the complete organism, which I think is awesome. I want to cover a couple things that were in your book. Now, you had said the two fatally mistaken concepts of medicine. Now, one was that humans are better off as pure organisms, free of microbes. Again, these are mistaken, folks out there listening. And number two, the human genome is the most important biological, really, in creating a better future for humans, a biological starter in creating a better future for humans. Let me ask you, how long did you wrestle with those two presumptions before you had this dream and realized that it's something more than that?
Not long, because, okay. And I don't mean, in saying that, I want to honor all of, I mean, I started life as an immunogeneticist, and in fact, in high school and beyond, I started out wanting to be a geneticist, and it turned out the way I got to do that was by working on the immune system. So my first thought was to be a geneticist, and Watson and Crick were new with DNA discoveries when I was young. I mean, that was new, revolutionary work. So honor the chromosomes and our genes that are human mammal genes. But the problem is they're not our majority, or the vast majority of our genes are microbial, over 99%. So that's just a numbers game. I mean, those genes are encoding proteins and other factors and enzymes that metabolize our food, and they're the first ones to see our food. So once you recognize that you know, genetics is really to the majority, and the majority genetically is microbial in us, and they're the ones that see the environment. They see the air we breathe. They see the food we eat, the water we drink, and what goes on our skin. And what they do with it determines what our mammalian human cells see and what our chromosomal genes get to, and their products get to deal with in terms of metabolism and signaling and interactions. So the chromosome that we so honored, the genes on those chromosomes become actually somewhat secondary. And that's not to say they're not important. That's not to say they don't do incredibly important things and that they can be useful in human health. We know they can be. But you may remember the Human Genome Project as essentially being touted as sort of the be-all, end-all to cure human disease. And it was a bit underwhelming in terms of the result, because there were far fewer genes than anticipated, and it was shortly thereafter then that the microbiome and understanding of the extent to which we're microbial became evident. So
I think that's why we've believed it for so long, is we just didn't understand the microbiome and the amount of bacteria in our body. Do you think that's why those long-held beliefs have been there?
No, I think we were taught it was us versus them. I think we grew up, and this is not, it's ironic, Alexander Fleming loved microbes. He created microbial art, and there are others that are actually extending that, microbes as an art form. They can be very beautiful and attractive in terms of presentations and representations. So he actually appreciated the microbes. He wanted dangerous ones killed, and he obviously discovered, again, sort of by serendipity, discovered antibiotics. I think the idea that we needed to kill all microbes is where we went wrong. And it's sort
and
of overreach.
Robert Cook, correct?
Yeah,
can
exactly.
Can you talk a little bit
idea.
About Robert Cook and some of the things that he believed and kind of a premise that's been set from him? Can you talk a little bit
about
that?
Well, it was very important in terms of, you know, the postulates he created are still sort of an anchor to much of the science that we do. And it was very important work. Again, in those days, keep in mind, the threat was from contaminated water and food, and you know, so infectious diseases were the killers. If you didn't die by lack of food or malnutrition or accidents or other things, then infectious diseases could get you. Particularly with the Industrial Revolution and with lack of sanitation, people moved into cities, and it was great for spreading disease, you know.
Yeah, many people don't know that history. But talk a little. Can you fill us in a little bit about that? I mean, how they would bring animals in to the cities when the agricultural revolution was over and we went to the industrial, this move of these farm animals even into the cities. And we think that's ridiculous, but they would bring in cows and they would be milking cows into dirty wash basins, and the bacterial threat was real, viruses and all
that.
Oh,
yeah.
Feel
and again, when you have humans packed in, I mean, all you have to do, one of my hobbies is actually Scottish history, and I've written with my wife some books on the goldsmiths of Edinburgh. Well, read about early 18th century Edinburgh. Read about sanitation, the high rises, the closes, and literally when they talked about people living higher up, that's because you needed to, because there was sewage in the, you know, running down the streets and running down the hills of Edinburgh, and you know, the higher up you were, the less you saw that every minute of every day, and so but also carrying, you know, helping to transmit infections as well, and so there were great things done in sanitation and progress, and you know, infant mortality was reduced, and so there were benefits, and so we got the idea that, gosh, you know, killing bacteria is helpful, and boy, we should kill them all. But what we didn't understand is that Earth is a microbial planet. I mean, that's the predominant life form on Earth, and that all higher organisms, not just us, but animals and plants, have their own microbiome. And there's a microbiome in the ocean and in the atmosphere, and there are microbes that literally help to produce rain and facilitate that, and basically traffic between the soil and plants up into the atmosphere, helping to precipitate rain and then flow back down. And so there's microbial flow all over the planet. There are communication networks of microbes where plants communicate through soil fungi and bacteria through soil, the root-associated bacteria. And so there's an internet of, there's a microbial internet. So we didn't realize that when we go on this rampage, uniformly trying to kill bacteria, because we got the idea educationally that they were bad, that they were dangerous, that they would kill us, that we actually wound up depleting microbes for us and for part of the Earth as well. And that's a very bad thing.
Let's talk about how, so Cook, Robert Cook and Fleming, you know, they had this idea of waging war. I think you did a really good job in your book of talking about that. It's this war waging against our microbes.
Yes.
How does that mean that we're waging war against truly ourselves? Can you delve into that a little bit about how much we are truly microbial? And you talked about the Earth, and I think that's amazing, and the internetworking, and touch on the microbes within us and our listeners right now that are literally communicating. You said there's an internet almost between plants. And let's talk a little bit about that, if you could fill us in, about how we're waging war against ourselves and how that inner network works a little bit, how microbial we really are.
Right. Well, by several measures, we're majority microbial. By cell number, it used to be thought it was as high as 90%. It's probably not. It's probably a slight majority, more like 57% or so, of our cells in our body are microbial rather than human mammalian. Again, I mentioned that over 99% of the genes are microbial within us. And so, you know, we're, you know, the human mammal is the minority within our body. And that's essentially by design. However you think we came to being, that's the reality of it. Mm-hmm. So think about how many appendages you can lose before you start to have a different life, to have changes. How many organs can you lose? Well, how many microbes can you lose? Because they're a part of you. Mm-hmm. And it turns out once you start to actually deplete your microbiome, and doing that by eating the wrong foods, by taking drugs that haven't been vetted for microbial safety appropriately, exposure to environmental chemicals that we thought were at doses and exposure rates that were okay for human mammals, but we never realized that they could be toxic for our microbes, those kind of things, and lifestyle choices where we just didn't understand, where we thought risk-benefit, that we were reducing risks of certain things, but not and gaining some benefit, and one would be elective cesarean section. We thought it was safe for babies. I mean, babies look great, you know, until they're diagnosed with asthma, and then lupus comes along, and celiac, and maybe a few other autoimmune conditions, psoriasis, multiple sclerosis, diabetes, obesity, heart disease.
Correct?
Yeah. Autism spectrum disorders. Yeah. So, you know, they look great, but we never realized what actually having a part of their body depleted, cut off, eliminated, and doing nothing about it, what that actually meant for that baby's health across a lifetime, or that group of babies with that experience. And so the baby has to self-complete. The one way or the other, the baby needs to get mom's microbes and continue to get those through breastfeeding, wherever that's possible, where that's feasible, because of both feeding the microbes and breast milk itself, providing additional microbes that are timed to the infant at that stage. And the mother's milk actually shifts the microbiome profile during the course of nursing over a period of months to over a year in some cases, and the profile shifts because the baby's getting older, and that's what the baby needs. So, boy, if you want to know how breast milk is tailored over millennia of evolution, look at what's in it that is only used by the microbes as a food source, some of the oligosaccharides that our cells can't digest, but the microbes use, and they use to mature. And then look at the microbial seeding that's additional through breast milk that actually is timed to the baby's development. So you cut that off, you've got two big problems. You're not feeding the microbes, and you're not supplying the additional ones the baby is supposed to get at that age. And we're only now beginning to realize the ramifications of those kind of changes. So, again, these are things that people simply didn't know. I want to mention, if you don't mind, one scientist who had it right, actually had it right, and this is the Nobel Prize-winning immunologist Metchnikoff, who in the early 1900s, 1905 or so, discovered Bulgaris, the Lactobacillus bulgaris, the cultures that were in Eastern Europe that were part of milk, fermented milk, and he started drinking them, and he studied how immune cells handled bacteria. He won the Nobel Prize because he found the function for macrophages, among other things, that are one of my favorite immune cell types in the body,
I didn't know that. Okay.
And he wrote about the importance of consuming fermented foods and consuming this Bulgaris culture. And he firmly believed that it made him more vigorous, that it made him more resilient, and it made him healthier.
Would this have been kefir?
Yeah.
Consuming? a type of kefir?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So he, the problem was that unfortunately he died of a heart attack.
Oh.
So people looking at it, you know, the lay audience, general public looking at it said, oh, he was drinking this stuff and he died. So it can't be that good, so we shouldn't do it. And they kind of blew it off. And it's unfortunate because if we had listened, I mean, this guy won the Nobel Prize because he was that good in immunology.
Wow.
And they sort of just cut off the rest of the story because he died. Well, we all die eventually.
Yeah, we all
so
will eventually die.
The point is, it's a matter of how we do it and how much time before.
Well, hopefully do it
with quality of life and better health along the way. So the whole point is they ignored that part. Otherwise, Cook and the others that were driving the kill-all bacteria, that would not have been the theme. So I contend if only we had listened to Metchnikoff and learned more about macrophages and about his lactobacillus beverage consumption, we would be a lot better off.
If we had not,
the microbiome would have been ushered in. The microbiome would have been ushered in decades earlier in terms of our appreciation and understanding.
Wow, that's amazing. So people were breaking through, and there was light shining even back in the 1905.
There were people that knew. And there were bacteria. There were bacteriologists in the 60s that, like, were, you know, if you probably could tell you. There's some still around, I suspect, that could say, you know, we were trying to tell you guys, and you weren't paying attention to us. The bacteria were all over the place. They weren't all pathogens. They're there. They're doing something. They're there for a reason. You needed to appreciate that, and they would be right. You know?
And Roddy, what you talked about before with children being born, you know, it's almost like being born without a limb. And I want to cover that a little
bit
more later.
It is, yeah. And actually, the paper that I wrote that won the award from the Teratology Society, which I was not a member of at the time, by the way, was making that analogy that this is like a birth defect, but a correctable birth defect. And if only physicians treated it like that, you have a child with a correctable birth defect. Do something about it, please. And that was the paper that won, because I think it is a decent analogy. The baby is incomplete. You have the wherewithal to take on strategies that can help complete that baby, and the baby can benefit in terms of the life course and health across that life course. So it's time to do it.
Yeah, and I totally 100% agree with you. Now, I want to ask you some more questions about that a little bit later, but I want to cover something that is the consequence, really, and something that you've done in extensive research with folks from NYU and other very large colleges and universities. But NCDs, non-communicable diseases, can you just explain to folks that are listening right now, what are NCDs?
Yeah, these are the diseases and conditions, some of them are called conditions rather than diseases, that we used to say were chronic diseases. So, again, this is actually what kills up to about three-quarters of the global deaths now are from NCDs. Yeah. So if the early 20th century deaths were due to infectious diseases, the epidemics we have now are of non-communicable diseases. That's what's killing everybody. And so this is cancer, heart disease, obesity, stroke, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, autism spectrum disorders, all the 150 autoimmune conditions, lupus, psoriasis, autoimmune thyroiditis, MS, rheumatoid arthritis, celiac. So it is this massive collection of diseases that, because they occur in different parts of our body, have very different medical codings, and we assume they're not very similar. So asthma and psoriasis and celiac, and, you know, you look at them, you say, wow, they're in different parts of the body. The symptoms are somewhat different. They can't be related. Well, it turns out that one of the things I did with several of my colleagues was to look at the literature, again, from a somewhat different perspective, and say, if you start life as a child with an immune-driven NCD, so this would be things where people would say, well, the immune system's not operating correctly, and that's causing this pathology. So asthma would be an example in the lung. or inflammatory bowel in the GI tract, or, you know, psoriasis in the skin. Again, these are immune-driven and inflammation-supported problems. And ask the question, if you have that diagnosis, what comes next in that group? What is that group? What does the literature say the risk is for that group versus the general population? So you start to look at what we call comorbidity, or those diseases that go together, that lump in together. And once you do that, you're able to build a network of risk across a lifetime, health risk across a lifetime. And what we saw, and others have seen as well, is that the problem is when a pediatrician treats a child newly diagnosed with asthma, the pediatrician is usually treating the presenting symptoms.
Yes.
But there are double-digit numbers of additional non-communicable diseases and conditions to which that group, the asthmatic child, is at an elevated risk. So among the group of children, those diseases are going to be more prevalent as we're operating now with the medicine we're delivering now. That those diseases will be more prevalent as the child, as that group of children ages. That's not to say an individual child is going to get a particular disease. That's not necessarily true. It's the group together that we know that's what the future holds if we do nothing different. So one of the things I did in collaboration with these other researchers and in the book is to argue, look at what's happening. All of these diseases are moving together as an epidemic. So diabetes, autism spectrum disorder, asthma and allergic conditions, they've all been increasing quite dramatically over the last several decades, and yet we don't recognize that there's really a unified theme to why that's happening.
Yes.
There's actually an underlying mechanism in terms
yes.
of why these are all increasing, and quite frankly, it stems from the depleted microbiome and the improper education of the immune system.
Yes, can you talk a little bit about that? Because you had said in your book, so that was one of your tenements, is that having one NCD, or non-communicable disease, would garner itself to another. But there's really an amazing thing that I think you covered and I really appreciated, which is that another part of non-communicable disease is inflation and inflammation and uncontrolled inflammation. Now, could you kind of just give us an idea of how the microbiome affects mitochondria, how the microbiome affects the immune system, and how the microbiome being depleted increases our inflammation, and why that causes some of these problems? Because I know that obesity is an inflammation disorder, right? You're dealing
yeah,
with
yeah.
inflammation
so is
in your
depression,
body.
So is major depressive disorder.
Yes.
One of the
and
most
autism,
heavily
they're
prescribed,
finding too.
Yeah, one of the most heavily prescribed conditions is an inflammation condition, basically. And part of the proof for that is some of the categories of drugs that resolve what we call acute inflammation, that resolve that. And there's actually a category of drugs called resolvins, because that's what they do. And they're a little like omega-3 fatty acids that we consume, but not quite, but the same okay. same kind of chemicals. And when they resolve inflammation, it turns out they work pretty well against these different diseases that looked very different to us but aren't so different.
Wow.
So they will work against NCDs that may be gut, skin, and lung, because if you get rid of inflammation before you have pathology in the organ, you got a better chance of actually controlling the non-communicable disease. You're not just chasing what we would say end-stage mediators. So for allergy, it might be histamine. You're chasing histamine. But histamine is sort of the end product. It's not the beginning of
yes.
the allergic, of that type of allergic response.
They're trying to conquer and, the divide. Really,
yeah, and to get at the beginning, you've got to go back to what's wrong with the immune system in part.
Wow, that is so fascinating to me. So these resolvins, but we could do that naturally with our bodies. If
yeah,
we
can.
Just start,
we can sure help. We can sure help, and we need to.
Doing the rebiosis.
Things like think about depression and some of the side effects from some of these the mood and neurobehavioral things. And there's a whole group of literature now called psychobiotics that the term has been coined by Professor John Cryon at at University College in Cork, Ireland, and his colleagues, Dr. Dynan and others, where they've been able to show that different microbes, different gut microbes, different gut bacteria make different neuroactive peptides, different neurotransmitters.
Neurotransmitters.
So you may or may not.
And,
yeah. Serotonin, dopamine, GABA, acetylcholine.
It's all in your gut.
So it's
that's
all in
crazy.
Your gut. And in fact, the gut itself, not just the microbes, but the enterocytes. So gut cells, mammalian cells in the gut too, make neuropeptides, and the microbes make neuropeptides, and the microbes can regulate the gut production of neuropeptides by our mammalian cells so they can help control that. So it turns out that instead of taking this heavy-duty drug that's likely to produce all kinds of problematic side effects, you've already got a bacterium in you that will correct the problem. You just need more of it.
Wow. And we all see the
a natural correction.
They tell you the side effects. We don't want all the side effects.
Yeah. Why would you go that route?
Why would you go that route? Yeah.
Exactly. And yet we have trouble getting those kind of therapies through the FDA. So something already in you, you're simply going to adjust the amount of,
mm-hmm.
and that's a problematic study in some cases in terms of how the FDA views the procedures and the like. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist
or anything like that, but the pharmaceutical companies, I don't know if they could patent. microbiomes.
There are strains, and actually that's an important message, is all Lactobacillus acidophilus are not identical. There are strains that carry particular sets of genes or isolates, and consumers need to pay attention to those isolates, because you might buy something with the bacterial genus and species name and think you're getting just exactly what you need, but it may not be carrying the genes that are going to be the functionally what you need. So if people have isolated or worked on a particular strain and that has shown benefit, and a lot of times they actually do some of the studies with college students. College students are under a lot of stress. Again, our campuses are places where infections can be spread. They're under lots of stress. And so if you want to do mood behavior and resiliency, that's not a bad place to do it. We pay a lot of attention to resiliency at our universities and trying to elevate resiliency among everybody.
Can we
on the
dig
campus.
More into that?
So people can show real benefit using some of these probiotics, but the strain does matter, because it's the set of genes you want, not just a bacterial name. You want the set of genes where there's proven results.
So what we would say for that with Vital Gut Health, and to our listeners out there now, is you should just do your best to get as large a variety of probiotics into your diet as possible. So eating fermented foods. And I don't want to, can you cover a lot of that in your book? I don't really want to cover all of that today. I want to keep digging deeper into the importance of gut health, because you had a quote in your book that said, "We are microbial storage machines designed to pass our microbes along to future generations." And I thought that was just awesome. I mean, that just popped out on the page at me. So can you talk a little bit about how that happens? So how we pass on, how mothers part and all that, and how really our microbiome, so the mother's part, and then how our microbiome is like a rainforest. And kind of describe that so people can understand more of the importance of these microbes in your body.
Right. So we have billions of microbes in the body and thousands of different species. And in fact, single locations like the GI tract or the skin have over 1,000 different bacterial species. And they're tailored very exquisitely to the location. So for example, the bacteria in your armpits and underarm bacteria they may like a moist environment, whereas others that are on your forehead that might see more sun and they're the desert loving microbes of our skin. So there's a whole cartography that's been done on three-dimensionally on these different niches, these different environments or ecological areas where different microbes live on us, and they're designed and tailored in their metabolism what they do for themselves, what they do for us, what they get for themselves by interacting with us, is all tailored to the region. So microbes in the colon that may not see much oxygen and may be actually using hydrogen and producing methane and what we considered, well, analogous to those that were in the earliest stages of Earth when oxygen was not present, those love parts of our colon. We have those bacteria, relatives of those bacteria in our colon, whereas others in other regions are again, very different. So there's this whole myriad of microbes that are tailored exquisitely for our different body sites. And they are in metabolic and signaling communication with our human cells. And for example, for the immune system, 70% of our immune cells, approximately 65 to 70%, are in the gut.
Wow.
And they're in communication with the microbes that are on the very thin layer of gut barrier separating our microbes from this majority of our immune cells.
And that same tissue is your gallbladder and the back of your throat, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And things like bile salt metabolism are critical, where the microbe interaction with that is absolutely critical. So that's actually what educates the immune system in terms of what the environment looks like. They're on what is essentially the outside of our gut, communicating across the barrier with the immune system and conditioning it and training it so that it knows what's safe and what's not safe. So what happens if if the immune system doesn't get trained? It doesn't know what it should react against, and eventually it's going to react against your thyroid or against other parts of your body or against pollen or against food proteins and an allergic response. And that's exactly why we have these aberrant reactions, is we've not had the training that our ancestors used to get. So how does the microbiome, to get to your question, how does this happen for the baby? Well, mom's microbiome is obviously in place, and we used to think the womb was completely sterile, and that's probably not true. The placenta has microbes.
That blew my mind.
There are some microbes that are there. They're somewhat limited. There's not a great diversity, but and there's still an argument whether the baby has any prenatal seeding. There's going to need to be more research to really answer that in a meaningful way. But what we do know is the presence of those microbes there is already training our physiology prenatally. So that baby is already getting influenced by microbial metabolism through the placenta, and that is affecting prenatal development. Antibiotics for a pregnant woman. In fact, I have told OBGYNs, they have a new mission in their career, two-generational health. They should help the mom acquire, rebiose, optimize her microbiome for her better health, but also in preparation for the donation.
Yes.
You actually have malleable,
as you said.
Yeah, you have a malleable majority genetic donation that mom is going to make to the baby.
Wow.
And that's where that partnership of rethinking what physicians are doing in pregnancy would be really valuable. Help the mom's health and prepare what the baby needs.
Can you continue with what you're saying? I've got a couple questions for you on Martin Blaser and his work on the legacy we leave our children. And you talk a lot about kinship in your book. So let's just keep going on this. I really like this information. We need to learn this.
Right. There is this prenatal or during pregnancy conditioning of our physiology from where the microbes help. But then it is really vaginal delivery. Whenever that is possible, that is where the major seeding event occurs. So as the baby comes down the birth canal, there's a combination of both vaginal and some cecal material is in there as well, and so you have GI tract contribution to the baby. The baby comes out literally covered with mom's microbes.
So washing the baby at that moment is a terrible idea.
Yeah, it's not the best.
Yes.
You're going to remove the microbes, and unless the physician has a plan for put putting in what's needed, it's something to think about.
Yeah.
So that's the major seeding event, but it continues with skin-skin contact. And so, again, that's where the baby starts to acquire additional microbes.
Wow.
And then nursing, breast milk, the next seeding event, and it progresses. So here are the options that we have. You can have, whenever possible, natural childbirth, vaginal delivery, the seeding. You have skin-skin contact, breastfeeding when that's possible for an appropriate duration, or elective cesarean. You miss the seeding event. You miss the baby trafficking down the vaginal canal. You have antibiotics usually administered because it is a surgical procedure, and surgery usually comes with antibiotics. So you miss that, and you're likely to be in a hospital. So what kind of microbes is the baby going to acquire?
Wow.
Hospital-associated microbes.
Yeah, super microbes that are resistant to antibiotics.
Yeah. They'll be from hospital workers, but you've got the hospital environment, and that is a risk. You have more things like Clostridium difficile, and some bacterial agents that are prevalent in terms of transmission in hospitals.
And then the mother has the option to feed the child formula, so they can go down that rung with a C-section, being born in a hospital, antibiotics, and then feeding them formula without the proper probiotics.
Yeah, I actually published a paper. I was invited to do a review in a journal called Neo Reviews. That's a pediatrician-oriented, I think it's American Association of Pediatrics, actually. It's one of their journals. And I actually developed a figure that's called the worst-case scenario for the baby. Actually, kind of through the life course, and it's like, and I include some environmental toxicants. I include, bisphenol A and baby bottle, and plastics and
plastics.
some very nice immunotoxic and chemicals, and again missed microbial seeding, some food emulsifiers that will damage the gut microbes and promote obesity and some things like that. And so I put all of those in the figure and kind of showed you how to really have some microbial destructive mediated issues that
to say the least.
Normally we would think we're okay. I mean, until recently we thought, well, this is the easy path. This is the path I may need to take, and because we didn't know any better.
Yeah. Now, what would you recommend? I do want to just cover this briefly, maybe a couple minutes on this. If a mom has done that and she's maybe started out formula feeding, how would you recommend that we help this child from that point forward, maybe after the first birthday? Because we all know that immune systems really form in those first few weeks, and if you miss that, it can be really tough for your kid. What would you say? I mean, do we go 100 on a scale of 1 to 10? Do we hit 100 on trying to give them probiotics and do all these things and get them out in nature and get them in the soil, because the soil microbes that we're talking about with the earth? I mean, what would you recommend? I mean, what would be your maybe ray of hope for a woman who's done this? Because I know personally a lot of friends who have taken that path.
Yeah, and again, this is not in no means. Keep in mind, moms are operating with the best health professional supportive advice, and sometimes that's been lacking of the microbiome piece, and so they're doing the best they can, and I want to make that point that no one should feel at all bad or guilty or whatever. We do the best we can. I grew up in San Antonio in the 50s, and in addition to Mexican food, I'm sure I ate a lot of fried chicken, and realize now, boy, I should have been eating kale, shouldn't I? That would have been a lot better. Nobody was eating kale in San Antonio in 1950s.
Well, you're in Ithaca
that I know
now,
of,
so, you can get kale anywhere. Organic,
yeah,
course,
exactly. So, you do the best you can, and we need to recognize that. But, yes, everything you mentioned, our connection to soil, our connection to animals. If you're going to have a furry pet, you are better actually to have that pet in the household in birth, early infancy, or pregnancy, birth, early infancy, than bringing a pet in A lot of people will say, I'll wait until my child is 5 or 6, then I'll bring a pet in. And that's a prescription actually for a higher risk of a pet-related allergy.
Wow.
So you need the allergens in there and the microbes early.
Wow.
If you're going to do it. Now, there are some exceptions. And by the way, this is a good point to identify. I am not an MD. This is not medical advice.
Of course.
This is my best immunology perspective as a professor and not an MD. Mm-hmm. So consult your physician for medical advice.
Always, folks. Please always consult your
physician. But immunologically, if the family is not genetically atopic, and that is they simply inherited multiple allergies all the way down the line, and there are some conditions where that's the case. If they're not in that category, they are actually reducing the risk of response to those allergens by having them in early with as many of the microbial exposure as they can get, safe microbial exposure, going and licking hospital surfaces and things like that.
That's what people
do. So you actually benefit by the soil. There's early studies that showed that if pregnancy and infancy occurred on animal farms that didn't use pesticides but had livestock, lower risk of allergy.
That's
pure and simple.
I grew up on
you've got
farm.
The microbes, you've got the allergens, you've got the soil, you've got the animals will help spread. Your dogs are a microbe spreading machine.
Yep.
They love it. If you think about it, I show a slide when I give presentations, and I'm in the vet college too, so I'm almost obligated to show animal slides.
Okay.
So I show a slide of dogs greeting each other. I think I talk about this in the book. Do dogs greet each other mouth to mouth? No.
No.
It'd be a big mistake, first of all. No, they don't. It's nose to tail.
Nose to tail.
So,
nose to tail
is saying, hey, who are you microbially? That's your majority anyway.
Wow.
I want to see who you are, and are you sharing any useful microbes today?
Wow, that is incredible. I've never thought of it that way.
Just look at animal behavior. They'll tell you what the world really is.
Wow.
We get a little self-absorbed.
That's wonderful. That's really good, solid information for somebody. I mean, just go as hard as you can. If that is you, don't feel guilty. You've had the best information possible. But you can, as you talked about in the book, rebiosis, you can do this for your child. You can do it for you. There are so many foods out there and so many different things. We talk about it on our blog, and really, Dr. Dietrich gets in here and just nails it with everything in this book. And his third section, which is caring for yourself, is going to give you a lot of information that you need. Now, can you just touch on one last thing with us? We're almost out of time, but I really want to cover this because it is incredible information for people out there listening. You talked a lot about the Human Genome Project when we first started chatting about how it was really underwhelming and how we thought for so long, and we were taught growing up, that genes influenced everything, but now we've discovered this little thing called the epigenome. And can you just explain to us the epigenome and then explain to us how the microbes affect the expression of the genes by affecting the epigenome?
Right. So the epigenome, or epigenetics as it's called, is really the regulation of whether a gene is turned on or turned off, and when it's turned on or turned off, and the extent to which it is active. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with a whole variety of chemical and molecular targets that can be controlled in ways that we only learned about fairly recently in science history. And it turns out that having a gene doesn't mean a lot unless it's active. You know, then you actually see the ramifications of carrying that gene. So microbes are, in addition to having their own genes and being able to express them and have the products of those, they can affect your liver metabolism. They can affect a whole variety, you know, again, what the immune system is doing and what genes it's using and the extent to which it's doing it. And they can do this through epigenetic regulation. So that is controlling or regulating the extent to which a gene is turned on or turned off, a particular one. And that pattern, we used to think that pattern was very transitory, but some wonderful researchers, among them Michael Skinner at Washington State and others, have shown that you literally can transmit from parents to children these epigenetic features of genes being turned on or turned off. So that's very interesting. That means, for example, we now know that, and I talk about this in the book, that populations that underwent radical change, lifestyle changes, so famine during World War One or World War Two, rather, the Dutch famine and the like, that those changed gene expression epigenetically. The change in early life of food availability had major changes in gene expression. And those changes actually persisted. Even though food was available, they persisted across generations.
Wow.
And it's not that they're forever, but there is a persistence. So that's another way that the microbes you carry can actually imprint genes and imprint their activity, and that imprinted gene can, that state of that gene is transferred with your chromosomes.
Wow.
And can persist across more than just one generation in some cases. So it's interesting to me as a toxicologist as well, when we see adverse effects that are occurring and affecting health, are those all from the present day, or are some of those from a decade or two ago? That's a legitimate question.
Yeah, and then we start to see now, even in America, and this would be very causal, but obesity and this carry on of obesity and the promulgation of so many different, as you said, NCDs that branch out. In your book, you talk a lot about
yeah.
this.
Well, in obesity is, again, there are lots of ways to get to obesity, but one very simple one is that we know about is to thin the mucin layer that lines the gut barrier.
Wow.
If you do that, you bring bacteria into adjacent to and into proximity with both those cells and some of their products going through to the immune cells, and you basically cause unwanted activation of the immune system. Improper, unwanted activation of the immune system. And that will change the immune system in such a way to help whiten your adipose tissue, essentially to keep the white adipose fat tissue versus the so-called brown or beige fat tissue that you want that's
yep.
more metabolically active. So what kind of things do that? Some heavy metals. Cadmium will do that. But also emulsifiers that are in our processed food. So those things that keep our food from separating, that are in ice cream and peanut butter and things like that, that keep our food smooth and are very common in our food supply. We thought these were safe, things like polysorbate 80, carboxymethylcellulose. They will kill the species of bacteria that help regulate the mucin layer. And in doing so, they selectively kill that. And in doing so, they thin the mucin layer, and they cause this breach, essentially, in the barrier function, leading to immune activation that will support and contribute to obesity.
And
so
it'll
very easy.
Leak lipopolysaccharides into the body, too.
Yeah, exactly right. That would be one of them. Exactly.
Which would cause
so you have this blow-through created just because you killed a what we would call a keystone species. That's your weak link. You can't afford to kill Akkermansia, for example, is one of the genus that is involved with this. And the problem is that these food products, these food additives that were tested and vetted to be safe, were never screened really for microbial safety, you know. And so they're not safe, but they're very prevalent. And so that's one of the reasons that as a toxicologist, I've argued we need to redo safety, because we didn't know that we weren't really modeling humans correctly. We weren't modeling safety for the superorganism.
Think about things like, okay, so that's just one thing in our environment that we're eating on a regular basis and whatever you want, you know, your cheesy puffs or whatever you're eating there that have these emulsifiers in them. But then you even talked about in your book a lot about the antibiotics and controlled animal feeding operations. What most people know as factory farms, that they are loaded with antibiotics, and you are absorbing those antibiotics through those animals.
Yeah, and it's a terrible strategy. I wrote editorials about it back in the 90s, arguing against that. And at the time when I was actually involved with some agricultural, I originally was hired at Cornell in the poultry science department.
Wow.
So to breed healthier, naturally healthier chickens. And antibiotics in animal feed was a very, very poor idea. So the problem is that gets into the environment. It's actually not good for the animals. And the dirty secret of that is the reason they're using it is not so much to protect health, but because it's a growth promoter.
Yes.
So if you don't have lipopolysaccharide working through the immune system to produce inflammatory cytokines that cause muscle to break down. If you don't break down muscle as fast, you have bigger breasts on chickens for the amount of feed you put in. That's why they do it.
Isn't it just
not
it's,
worth it?
It's very evil.
No, it is.
Never want to buy a chicken from a factory farm.
Yeah. Beyond that, I mean, antibiotics are only one category of drugs. So the problem is we've not vetted food additives. Well, we've not vetted drugs.
Yeah.
For safety for the superorganism.
We don't think about that.
So,
and they're not thinking about the microbiome in their studies.
No. So, for example, NSAIDs will damage specific parts of the microbiome. And microbiologists can tell you, they could look at your microbiome and tell you whether you've been taking ibuprofen or naproxen. Because each one will damage the microbiome, but it'll damage different bacteria within it. So they can look at that and they could say, oh, you've been taking this drug.
Wow, and you hear that all
that's
out there,
how good
you need
the
to
readout
stop
is.
Taking ibuprofen,
so the problem
talking
is
about over-the-counter drugs.
Yeah, but also prescription drugs too. But just, I mean, again, NSAIDs are very common, you know, and this is not to say if you need to take one that you shouldn't take one. It's to say we didn't recognize this risk, particularly where people are taking it on a regular basis. The problem is you have a risk of gastric ulcers that can develop if you take too much too long. So then you take antacids, proton pump inhibitors. But guess what? They're known to damage a different part of the microbiome.
Yep.
In the intestine.
Dangerous.
So none of these are really, truly without significant risk for the microbiome. And that's unfortunately the case for a reasonable percentage of existing drugs on the market today.
Wow.
Is they have a downside that people simply didn't know about.
Well, Dr. Dieter, I am so thankful you were able to share this information with us. And everybody out there listening, The Human Superorganism by Dr. Rodney Dieter. He really does a wonderful job at capturing all the things we talked about today, but this is only the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you couldn't sum this up. We could do 15 hours of conversation here and still not cover everything in his book. And really, the third part, taking care, caring for yourself, is really what you need to dig into in this book. You need to go out. This needs to be a part of your library. I've read many books from many doctors and neuroscientists and different people talking about the brain and how it's affecting the gut. And I will tell you, this is one of my top five books. I'm not blowing smoke here. This is amazing, groundbreaking research with the right questions asked and the right information. And Roddy, thank you so much for joining us. Your story, it just gives me chills, you know, the serendipitous nature of this book and how you discovered all this information, and we want to just get it out to as many people as possible. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Jake.
All right, thank you. We'll be in touch, and all for all you out there listening, thank you for joining us. Again, this is the Vital Gut Health Podcast. I'm your host, Jake Thurston, and we had Dr. Rodney Dieter. You'll see it in the show notes below. And The Human Superorganism. Get out there, buy this book. It is awesome. Thank you.